Blog Talk Radio.
The purposefulness and progress of masonry, and I think it'll come as a big surprise and no surprise. I again thank you very much it's just absolutely amazing. We have listeners from as far away as from where we are. But far away and close by, as close as the show. So thank you for tuning in, I've got some interesting and I think worthwhile music. But it occurred to taking a very deep and serious look at the process of masonry. I've been following the comments and activities of a woman from Britain who is the head of Women's Freemasonry, the Grand Master, I'm chuffed completely. Pleased in my mind that we have the growth, the natural evolution of masonry within women's group. It helps satisfy so many questions in my mind, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. The role or connection of women in the 21st century, although we, you know, if we want to pretend we're living in the 18th century, then we're doing a reenactment. You know, we're dressing and talking and developing affectations that really won't satisfy the test of authenticity, the intellectual test of authenticity. On the other hand, of the antiquarians amongst us, the people that help us to negotiate and understand the connectiveness of symbolism, will be able to help us remain connected with that, with the best parts of the past of this amazing order that's captured us, captured the imagination. Each and every one of you at some point will have established in your mind this sense of uniqueness, the search for more. Even as children, you had that notion that the what was popular wasn't not necessarily what interested you or fed you emotionally. You may not have put it in those types of words. Children rarely are that erudite. I'm flattering myself here, but you certainly had that sense of other, and looking for it brought you, opened the window to Freemasonry. To get us started today, I have a beautiful music from Paul Desmond. I think you'll really like this. It's called The Taste of Honey. Thank you. Absolutely beautiful. Absolutely. Thank you, Paul Desmond. Mind if I catch up, bring you up to date with some ideas on the process of the Enlightenment of Masonry? I thought you'd say that. If you look at the Masonic literature in our libraries, the historical material, yeah, it is one of the peculiarities, I think, in a way, the paradoxes, a better word, that Masonry has put so much on the page, the written word. Written word means that we no longer control the sense of mouth to ear, the oral history. And I think we might agree to entertain the idea that this was part and parcel of the impulse, the effect of one of the greatest events in the history of Masonry, the formation of Grand Lodge. That process was a departure. Up until then, I think it could be argued that Masonry was parochial. You and I and our mates would gather and meet, come up with, make connections with other people that we knew on a personal level, networking, and form our lodge, form our interests first, and then form our lodge. And those types of connections would happen in different places. As you and I left our lodge, we would have networks of people around us, and some of them would be so similar to us that we could share this experience and want to pass on the benefits and the satisfaction of being a member of the order, and would do that orally. And so on. You could see that this would be a series of cells, cells that functioned with a considerable amount of autonomy, out of sheer practicality. A tasting, we would never be too sure if the opportunity that they were served were consistent. So we wouldn't know if the ideology, the ethics and principles had been packaged, given it as a package to each and every lodge out there, some yes, some lesser, some more so. But it gave rise to an interesting phenomena. As long as we remain, as the idea, the spirit of Masonry occurred through oral history, you can imagine it would take a great long time to go anywhere. Now, that said, nothing stops or revolves around, we don't have geocentric notions of Masonry in the world. Masonry is adaptive. And so as we traveled, so traveled our ideas and our experiences. And we brought this notion, that parochial notion with us. And when we stepped onto a foreign shore, that parochial experience, that camaraderie, the benefits came with us. And we would pass them on to like-minded people that we connected with. Whether in the course of doing business or as adventurers, explorers, agents of government. And we began, of course, to realize that wherever we were, if somebody was right-minded, they could connect with people connect with other fellows and have the types of conversations that allowed them to know the person's character and share the experience again and start the process again, because the process itself was portable, but the vehicle that was the peripatetic. So at the onset, Freemasonry was a product of the wanderer, the visitor. And I think that's more than reasonably assumed and understood from the literature, Masonic literature. We call it progress. We know, the progress. We're rewriting our history and getting it more accurate and getting it right as we gather here today. It's happening more and more. This notion of imperialism has become folly. We just do pass every year date commemorating the Christopher Columbus. Columbus will have to just take the heat for this one because of his so-called discovery of North America, ignoring the fact that there are about 2,000 unique language groups, political systems of justice and law going on across North America before he arrived. We just ignore that. It wasn't up until 1960. This kind of mentality existed in quite a profound way, and probably does in some dark recesses that haven't been found out yet. Aboriginal people in Australia were considered under the Flora and Fauna Act. They weren't considered human, and they were treated that way, treated as beasts of burden. 1960. For a man my age, that's striking. It's a bit perplexing. That's a very sad commentary. Rightfully so, not only making amends, there's a debt owed how do you erase that? How do you erase treating people as slaves or subhuman? How do you do that? I hope that debt is never paid, but people are always striving to pay that. It's a legacy that's shameful. It's the same kind of legacy we see in parts of the world where there's, deniers, the nations that don't have the courage, the moral courage to step up, take responsibility for their actions, move on, become those deniers. And that means that their legacy, the decay, haunts them until it's resolved. And then, even then, it stings. We have to be able to, as good people, be able to handle failure repeatedly without, not just to be able to handle it and bounce back, but it must never affect our enthusiasm. We have to be able to remain devoutly enthusiastic to whatever tomorrow it will bring, and be able to experience those unexpected and torturous turns in our lives, where we experience failure and rejection and discomfort. The artwork, if you think of Masonry on a map, the peripatetic Mason would pass it on, and we have that sort of romanticized notion of bringing in the traveler and welcoming him and him being able to be recognizable to us. The practical side of it is it separates out true Masons from the... we hear the practical side is, does if everybody is aware of that romanticized and beautiful aspect of Masonry, then we can conduct ourselves as gentlemen, and it is a wonderful experience. However, if somebody is unaware, is ignorant of the history of our order, then they cannot extend that aspect of Masonry to anybody, anyone, including themselves. They won't expect it of others. And so they let us know their skill level as a Mason by their very behavior, regardless of their rank and position. Interesting exposure. One of the interesting characteristics of Masonry is the constant requirement for authenticity. Let's bring that full circle up and examine, if we can, if we will, some of our values. So Masonry, in days not so very long ago, was extolling the status quo, of course, and singing the praises of the fraternity and conviviality and mutual benevolence. Yeah? Help. All encourage virtue. So in order to that, those seem to be important aspects that would be the almost in the day past the sole criteria for status within a lodge. And so the orders, the peripatetics, went on sometimes contradictorily to allude frequently to the large number of gentlemen and aristocrats, even kings, who proudly shared in the Masonic mysteries. So much for our sense of equality. To be able to say, look at all these famous people, they were Masons. Why, as a man who embraces the notion of equality, would I be talking about the accomplishments of the gentry? Oh, did you know? Why would I do that? It's not, does it go on or not? Or is it right or wrong? Or does it rub me the right way and you the wrong way? But why? Doesn't that disavow this whole notion of us committing to some sense of fraternity? Yeah, but it happens. It happens. But we were also, and we were very proud when we're doing that. We're very proud of those mysteries. Huh? But as we share the values, we know that they need to occur. That kind of sharing occurred only in privacy and secrecy. And the emphasis should be placed within the lodges on the liberal arts and sciences. You need to realize that not so very long ago, well-rounded gentlemen, and I presume you, the listeners, are of that caliber, would be wanting to understand the aspects and attributes of a well-rounded true Mason and gentleman. And we're told how to do that. Choice. We're given that choice. You accepted it. Ancient and accepted. So we're left with the beauty of exploring the liberal arts and sciences. Now, that means we need to, there's some qualifiers there. Particularly an emphasis on geometry. And these are the things that improve and civilize mankind. You can be told that. I could give you an opinion about that, or somebody, it was one listener who's much more skilled than I, would be able to articulate that, tell us what that means. But I think the hint here, or a broad hint, is that, hey son, this is something that you need to sit down and understand for yourself. If you don't understand what a liberal arts and science education is, then that's your first task. You don't have to necessarily make a fool of yourself. We don't consider that not knowing is foolish and embarrassing. But are you relying on the riding on the coattails of others? At the start, as a student, as a raw recruit, perfectly fine to be riding on the coattails, that's where you see reading lists and discussions of people that will allow you to open your thoughts and to understand and articulate. So we begin to see those student debates happening in lodges, the excitement. And if truth be known, they never change. It's not that the status quo remains. It's the youthfulness, the new, fresh mind embracing these ideas with an enthusiasm. And that enthusiasm doesn't die. And it's absolutely remarkable. We see that similar process in colleges and universities around the world. And it doesn't let up. It's the beauty of education, that wonder. Once you hear the idea, you need to be able to articulate, share it, tell people that you have this idea, and then tell people what it means. And you hear others pushing back a bit, telling you what they think that idea requires. And that's how we form and develop the precision of our thinking, that process of give and take. Now, this means we have to be of a certain emotional character. Somebody going into those kind of enriched environments, believing that only their ideas are right and everybody else is wrong, will be a very obnoxious little person, but will be quickly ignored, unless what they're bringing forward is the process of discovery, unless what they're talking about is the results of their thinking, that primacy. And that's what we want to foster, that outlier that has that Tesla, that Einstein, that monk has the idea that is remarkable and able to add to our overall knowledge base. That whole process requires an acknowledgement. Does it make sense? Well, we used to be able to, by comparison, we look back and think that we used to have more time. We never had more time or less time. Time is what it is. And quite frankly, I haven't really the wherewithal to explain to you what it is. So we'll just, please, I'm embarrassed, but just leave that aside. Can't begin. Today, those discoveries and that type of addition to knowledge is happening at a very accelerated pace because, for a lot of reasons, people have their tabletop laboratories. You don't have to be part of a formalized environment in order to do your research. It's adding, but that need for validation is still apparent. Because we have charlatans, people that want to get something for nothing. We know that. We have that in our own history. Didn't we have some history where somebody wanted some of the secrets, some of the really powerful knowledge handed to them without doing the work, without being qualified? And we know as Masons the consequence of that. It's very, very serious. Let's just leave it at that. The work then becomes for us the process of validating these ideas. What is useful, and what is useful right now in a practical sense? Because one of the hallmarks of our order is practicality. We take these wonderful, lofty notions, and we render them down to a practical level. We help others. We define charity. And we understand it. So there we have the student standing at the door of the lodge, needing to and wanting to explore the benefits of the order and the potential to test, to see if he does apply himself, can he taste the benefits? Can he experience the benefits as they've been outlined by others around? And for some, the study, being a self-directed learner, begins to emerge. So uniformly, these writers claim to represented ancient and generally an Egyptian and Hermetic wisdom. If anything, sort of staggered me. It was the notion that I was hearing about these things without understanding what they meant. And it seemed that a line or a paragraph in some of my research wasn't enough. What in the world was Hermetic wisdom? So they're here. In this way, we're looking at comparative understanding. It's not like, oh, we're going to go to create a bottle of single malt whiskey. We're going to compare. How does this one that I produce here in my village compare to the one over the mountain, where your spring water is a bit different and your recipes are a bit different and your malting process is a bit different? So we compare, we realize that the world that of the liberal arts and sciences has a lot of color on that palette. It's not just that entropic gray, that we can give tonality and at the same time give texture to our experience and our thinking. We know that there are pleasures of social harmony, and Masonic rhetoric embraces that as a model the universe proclaimed by Newtonian science. In 1779, for example, a Kent vicar and Freemason James Smith was preaching before his lodge and employed language drawn from the Newtonian tradition to illustrate the necessity and power of benevolence. He says, attraction binds the universe as benevolence binds men. I think I'm not necessarily prone to agree because somebody says it, but that's a curious and interesting comparison. But and that's reinforced in similar language in the same period by Daniel Turner, who happened to be an Anglican minister in Norwich. And he urged brothers to practice philanthropy, which is not confined to name or sect. Didn't matter if your name had a lot of vowels in it or no vowels in it, or whether you practiced the same faith that I did. Philanthropy. But like the power of attraction, which reaches from the largest to the smallest bodies in the universe, it unites men from the throne to the cottage. Enlightenment. So the early Newtonians within us, a great emphasis upon order and stability and the rule of law. You see the growth and progress in defining our order and defining the process of constitutional law. Now we are experiencing this notion that this is connected with Newtonian theory and drawing on the laws of physics and applying them to the lives of human beings. Everybody needs to fill up their tumblers there with Kool-Aid. Here's a little something from 1939. I think you'll like it. Jet and Dry Swings, Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli. This is from a live performance.
Magic strings of the instruments of these five musicians was formed the quintet of the Hot Club of France. ¶¶
absolutely amazing. Well, sets the tone, doesn't it? We from days gone by, we weren't so shy about singing together and bringing music into our meetings. And some places, some listeners out there will be scratching their heads with that, because they do bring their voices together and enjoy good music, huh? But round off today by bringing us back a little bit to reflections and an understanding of the some of the original ideas that gelled and became part of the fabric of masonry. So we, as we examine this, we realize that belief in the order proclaimed by science encouraged Masonic fantasies about the possibility of creating perfect harmony in human society, if only within the confines of the lodge. And I must admit, I said that occurred to me. Wouldn't it be wonderful if more people shared this kind of experience, and then with this notion of equality perched on my shoulder, why can't that be everyone? And wouldn't the world be? Yeah. So then, but the Newtonian model explicitly proclaimed a rigid spiritual hierarchy within nature and, by implication, within society. Spiritual forces, active principles, rules over brute and stupid matter. Not surprisingly, Masonic aspirations for stability and perfectibility were not always compatible. Masonic idealism carried within its boundaries an inherent tension. Harmony required perfectibility. I have great difficulty with that. That's a failing of mine. I'm not perfect. And any of you who have met me will attest to that. But even if this could be achieved within a lodge, indeed, if it ever be sealed off, could it be ever sealed off from the larger society around us? Yeah. If we could find that perfect balance of perfect harmony within a lodge, how would that function with the universe around us? Would that tend to change our expectations of us as a man rather than us as a Mason? But curious, I wasn't aware of this. In the 1760s, our history shows that there was, when agitation for reform came about, led by Wilkes, it threatened to destabilize society and government. And Masonic orators acutely reflected both the agitation of the country and the stability symbolized by the court. So for most of the century, Masonic orators dwelt upon their utopian vision. They savored certain especially pleasing and salutary aspects of their benevolent, progressive, and, as they imagined it, ancient creed. We always go back to being the oldest because it gives us a sense of authenticity, propriety. We're really the oldest. We're older by an hour. We're older by a minute. We're older by a century. And yet, none of us can explain what the hell time is. funny bunch, don't you think? One of the most commonplace expressions of that sentiment appeared in the standard almanac used year in and year out by the practicing Freemason, the Freemason's Pocket Companion. That first appeared in 1735. I think we've Casa de Graham around here, I think we've got a copy of that sitting on the shelf. And that was followed by a multitude of editions and translations. Yeah, I have one of those. And on the continent, these companions were sometimes called catechisms. Each copy contained a reprint of the 1723 constitutions and lists and addresses of known lodges in London and the environs, and Masonic feast dates and songs, and a short but largely mythical history of the progress bestowed upon humanity by the fraternity. We had it all. But the companion informed its possessor about that the growth of Freemasonry augurs the pleasing prospect of having, even in our own days, the arts of the famed Augustan age revive amongst us. This is an easy equation made between the building of public and especially domestic mansions and the revival of learning. The ancient Romans had enjoyed such a revival, but it was destroyed by those terrible Goths. Really. But with very little knowledge of geometry, gave us the ugliness of the Gothic. The Renaissance of Italy, more especially the great Palladio, revived the Augustan style of architecture, and Inigo Jones, you may have heard that name, the great court architect of the early 17th century, brought it to England. Masonic architects are portrayed at every turn as the harbingers of cultural revival, which is symbolized totally in the splendid Palladian mansions of the new oligarchy. The Freemasons gloried in the transformation of the royal style of the 17th century into the court and hence oligarchical style of the 18th. See, that's us. See, we're aware of that process. That's Augustan. That's not Gothic. Gothic bad. But you and I, we may find the interiors of the surviving mansions garish. This was not the judgment of the contemporaries who identify with the cultural values they proclaimed. And in urging him to identify with the opulence of the court, the pocket companion told the Freemason that places like Houghton Hall in Norfolk, built by the great oligarch Prime Minister Robert Walpole, was in itself a sure sign of cultural vitality. The Palladian style, as it appears in the new mansions of the oligarchs, thrilled the Masonic imagination. It was pagan and ancient and ornate and yet symmetrical. Amazing. And most, you want to hear what turned us on, what thrilled us in the day? Most of these huge edifices and landscape gardens, whether that's off your balcony or your backyard, surrounded by vast landed estates, symbolize the private and domestic realm of patronage, prosperity, and power. Out of these private enclaves came the foundations of an order and a stability imitating the cosmic order decreed by providence and confirmed by scientific observation. So maybe in a way we're all students at the knee of Einstein. I've always found great satisfaction with his notion that the demonstration of the Creator is around us everywhere in nature. The natural order of physics. I found great, great balance in that type of notion. A Masonic poet, a little poetry from 1739, with more enthusiasm than literary talent. Here, I'll just read a stanza for you. But order and simplicity alone, which in fair nature's works so fair are shown, which now the schemes of architecture fill, can claim just wonder or display just skill. But these old Greece and Rome their schemes did raise, and shone the patterns of succeeding days. By these their generous modern sons are known, a Kent, a Flintcroft, and a Burlington. We went right after it. Of course, we were enthusiastic about this. And an early anonymous Masonic tract accepted an essentially Hobbesian view of the brutality of the original human condition. And that means, you know, who was Hobbes? And what was he saying that made this reference so compelling? And mitigated not by the establishment of a contract, but rather the institution of civilizing domestic units built by Masons. Like this. The race of man in full possession of wild and savage liberty, sullen and solitary, mutually offending and afraid of each other, hid themselves in thickets of the woods or dens and caves of the earth. In these murky recesses, these cumbrous solitudes, the Almighty Architect directed Masonry to find them out and, pitying their forlorn and destitute condition, instructed them to build houses for convenience, defense, and comfort. And the construction of homes is only the beginning of human progresses, measured in Masonic terms. A plenitude of riches is the ideal, and the heart of the utopian fantasy. That anonymous writer went on like this. Some of our brethren, from their exalted situation in life, rolling in their chariots at ease and enjoying every luxury, pleasure, and comfort, may with strict propriety be considered as standing on the basis of earthly bliss, emblematic of the greater square which subtends the right angle. Others whom Providence hath blessed with means to tread on the flowery meads of affluence are descriptive of the squares which stand on the sides which form the right angle. But what of those who cannot hope to achieve such extraordinary wealth in their lifetime as to stand on squares supporting the Masonic edifice? Are they to be banished from the Masonic paradise? Here's what the early writer had to say. Those who, by application to peculiar arts, manufactures, and commerce, from their several productions not only add to the wealth of the nation and to the happiness of the exalted, but have the heartfelt satisfaction of administering to the wants of the indigent and industrious, may with strict justice be compared to the angles which surround and support the figure. The lodge differs from the domestic unit only in that it admits men of a variety of ranks, from the exalted to the industrious, and even occasionally to the now indigent and once industrious. All may join in the intimacy of its secret proceedings. Indeed, just as the domestic sphere teaches obedience to authority, order, and charity, so too the Masonic Lodge, in the words of one of its founders, seeks to civilize, to subdue the passions, to promote morality, charity, good fellowship, good nature, and humanity. The lodge is to the cultivation of social virtue as the home is to private virtue. That's how Reverend R. Green, a Masonic preacher from Durham lecturing in 1776 in Newcastle, summed up the meaning of the lodge very succinctly. It is a place of safe retirement where we may securely enjoy generous freedom, innocent mirth, social friendship, and useful instruction. Oh. Little Ella Fitzgerald and our favorite Louis Armstrong.
I thought I found a man of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends? I thought for once it couldn't go wrong. Not for long, I can see the way this ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Never again, through with love, through with men. They play their game without shame. And who's to blame? I thought I'd found a man I could trust. What a fuss. This is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
Yes, I thought I knew the wheat from the chaff. What a laugh. This is how the story ends. I let her turn me down. Say, can't we be friends? But I did, I acted like a kid out of school. What a fool. Now I see this is the end. I let her turn me down. Say, can't we be friends? Oh, why should I care? Though she did for me the air. Why should I cry, have a sigh, and wonder why? Yes, I should have seen a single stop. What a flop. This is how the story ends. She's gonna take me down. Say, can we be friends?
Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as we've enjoyed being with you. Stay in touch. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and look to the horizon. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks. See you next week.